Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, an original production from KJZZ. Every weekday, we bring you the latest news and culture from across the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning and welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, a roundtable discussion on the future of First Fridays after violence has rocked the signature downtown Phoenix event. And a new AI platform from ASU has some professors upset. But first, state lawmakers are at odds with our Democratic governor over how to spend the shrinking state budget. Cuts need to be made, but the budget proposed by GOP members of the legislature this week added up to $800 million less than what Governor Katie Hobbs had proposed. The Republican plan includes across-the-board 5% cuts to just about every state agency, including adding new eligibility requirements to food stamp benefits and Arizona's Medicaid program. Republicans say it will save the state $180 million and weed out fraud in government programs. But the governor has already vetoed new restrictions like this. And it comes at a time when a record number of people have been dropped from SNAP, Arizona's food stamp program, to the tune of more than 450,000 Arizonans at last count. More than half of those are children. KJZZ's Cameron Sanchez is covering it all for our politics desk, and she joins me now in studio to tell us more. Good morning, Cameron.
Good morning.
All right. So, Cameron, let's start with these massive losses to the state's SNAP program. 450,000 people sounds like a lot of people.
Yeah, especially since we had about 900,000 people before that. So we're talking about roughly half the folks getting slashed. And that's just now. The number is still climbing.
OK, so there this is, I understand, bigger losses to a food stamp program in our state than any other state has seen, even though we're all kind of doing this because of conformity to this H.R. 1, the big, beautiful bill, so-called.
Right. Well, and that's what's so especially weird about it. So H.R. 1, which passed last summer in the federal Congress, said that we had to change the SNAP process and they want us to bring our error rate down in Arizona, which is something that the governor says DES, which is our State Department of Economic Security, which administers the SNAP program, is already in the process of doing. But whatever DES is doing is different from what all of the other states are doing because we've cut way more people way more quickly.
Right. OK, so these are what do we know about what's leading to this? What have they told you?
Well, DES has said they're just doing what they had to do to conform with federal law and that they're not doing anything beyond that. And they're also saying, well, we're understaffed, we're overloaded, you know, we're dealing with this backlog. They acknowledge that there is a large backlog of folks who are saying that they have issues with the program. But from folks we've spoken to who have been trying to get their benefits, especially people who have been on SNAP for a really long time, they've said, well, no, you know, I'm still eligible and I'm bringing all of my correct documents and things to DES, but I'm no longer able to complete the application process because they won't answer the phone or their system lags or it doesn't work. And then I get rejected and now I'm hungry and my family is struggling.
Technical
and it's not
issues.
Because of waste, fraud, and abuse, which is ostensibly what this was all supposed to get rid of.
And we should say you talked to those folks in line at the food bank, right?
Yeah, I did. I've spoken to those folks in a couple of places, but the food bank was one of them. And everybody actually said the exact same thing, which is rare when I'm talking to a group of people.
Yeah.
But yeah, one after the other, everyone who said that they had tried applying for SNAP said that the process had gotten harder and or that their benefits had been taken away.
Okay, now Republican lawmakers are proposing new eligibility requirements more than already exist or came down from the federal level. What kind of impact could this have?
Yeah, they're slipping that into this proposed GOP state budget. And these are bills that came at Governor Hobbs in separate bill form earlier in the year, which she already killed. There's two things there. Partly she's saying, well, it's not necessary because DES is already doing what they're supposed to be doing. So we don't need to add on to that. And second of all, they want to go like beyond what the federal law has required. So, for example, the federal changes say we have to have our error rate down to 6%.
Mm-hmm.
The federal bill puts penalties on that. But the state legislation that's proposed by Republicans would bring it down to 3%. So that's even stricter.
Mm-hmm.
And they're saying we need to do things even harder, have people check in even more frequently, apply even more often, meet even, you know, the strongest possible work requirements, everything.
Mm-hmm.
And Hobbs is saying no.
Okay. As you said, she has already vetoed legislation like this. Do we anticipate that to happen again? Or is this sort of a jumping off point to negotiate over what a budget might look like if they come to the middle?
I mean, the fact that they've snuck in a lot of things in this budget that she's already vetoed and not just in this portion makes me think that it's not going to be popular with her. Although we've gotten mixed messaging from Republicans. They say, well, this is a budget that has bipartisan gains. It's not just a starting off point. We really do think that this can pass. We're not just, you know, going through the motions of putting it up. But I mean, there's not been any enthusiasm from Democrats. It passed yesterday out of committee on party lines. Every single Democrat voted no. And there was some pretty nasty conversation, too, where they basically said, well, we don't need you and we don't care what you think.
The GOP plan here, though, and the governor's plan to some extent are trying to address a real problem, right, that we do need to cut spending. The state is facing a budget deficit.
Yeah, this is not the year where people are going to get to pay for their pet projects. The budget, you know, either way, we're going to have tax cuts. Democrats want a certain portion of tax cuts and Republicans want full what's called tax conformity, which means that we have to find a way to pay for that stuff. And there's not going to be a lot of new revenue. So they're looking at ways to slash. And one of those ways is agency cuts. So that means, for example, DES, the program that administers SNAP, would be taking a cut to their budget.
As they're saying, they're facing this big backlog.
Yes.
Republican lawmakers, what do they want to do with this $180 million in spending that they say they'll save here?
I mean, largely it is to pay for those tax cuts. So the tax cuts would cost a lot. And that $180 million number is just for the first fiscal year. I believe it's fiscal year 2028. So it's a variety of things. They're also looking to cut other programs. They want to cut funding to the Commerce Authority. They want to cut tax incentives for solar. And that hodgepodge of all of those cuts put together will pay for tax cuts.
We mentioned that they want 5% across the board cuts to just about every state agency, but not all. Which ones would be spared?
It's the ones they consider to be essential for public safety. So that's the Department of Public Safety, obviously, the Department of Child Safety, and the Department of Corrections, Rehabilitation, and Reentry.
Okay. So the one thing that the legislature has to do every year, the only thing they have to do, right, is pass a budget.
Yes.
What do you think this proposed budget from the Republicans and how it compares with the governor's proposed budget earlier on, what do you think that says about how far this will take to get a budget passed?
I mean, this whole thing of like going through the process of they have their budget and she has her budget. We did this last year. Last year was actually awful because they made us go through like two or three iterations of the budget before they finally passed something. And then there was threats of another budget. Anyway, that was exhausting. I think this year, you know, everyone knows this is their fourth year dealing with Hobbs. This is the fourth year in a divided government. They know what they have to do. They're going to get there eventually. And the fact that they don't have extra money to play with this year actually in some ways makes it easier because people are not going to die on the hill of their special project. So I think we're actually, you know, maybe even a little bit closer than we were last year, but still not at the finish line.
Okay. Well, we will watch and see what happens. KJZZ's Cameron Sanchez with our politics desk. Cameron, thanks as always.
Thank you.
First Friday art walks have been a staple of downtown Phoenix for decades, since the 1980s, when a small group of artists started the event as an answer to Old Town Scottsdale's blockbuster art walks. First Fridays became a huge success story for downtown Phoenix, a downtown Phoenix that was often a ghost town after 5 p.m. And as First Fridays have grown, downtown Phoenix has transformed from something of an urban wasteland to the thriving core of a growing city. But now organizers are pulling back. In recent years, the event has ballooned, and lately it's been plagued by violence, from fights to gunfire. Starting this First Friday, the Roosevelt Row CDC announced it will no longer be closing down streets where vendors have traditionally set up tables and sold their wares to crowds of people for the, quote, foreseeable future. It's a moment of reevaluation for First Friday, Roosevelt Row, and downtown Phoenix as a whole. And this morning, we're going to talk about it with one of the founders of the Roosevelt Row CDC, Greg Esser. Greg, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And Jesse Demery, a musician, a community organizer, a second-generation Phoenician. Glad to have you here, Jesse.
Thank you. Good morning.
Yeah. All right. So, Greg, I want to start with you and this recent decision from the CDC, from organizers, to stop closing down the streets. It sounds like this has been a long time coming. But tell us what led up to this decision.
It's, again, I think, as you implied, a decision that's been a long time coming. And this is a moment of reevaluation, basically taking a beat, reevaluating, getting stakeholder, resident, vendor input, and really evaluating what the best course is moving forward.
Yeah. There was a shooting nearby a First Friday. There have been fights that have broken out. I know last year Phoenix police were out there talking about, you know, enforcing juvenile curfews. Like, what's it started to look like?
Crowds attract all kinds of people. There are bad elements, and a few bad apples can spoil the apple cart. I think that's part of what's happened here, but it's not the only thing that's happened here. As you mentioned, the context has changed significantly. And when we started street closures back in 2005, 2006, 60% of the land in this neighborhood was vacant. There
60%.
Was
nothing. Wow.
It was literally a wasteland, and now we're 3rd Street and Roosevelt is the most densely populated residential intersection in the state of Arizona.
Wow.
That's a lot of residents that are negatively impacted by a street closure on the end of the work week. Mm. And so that's a new constituency that also has to be considered in evaluating the way the event moves forward.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll get into more of this in a minute, more about the changes that are being made and why. But I want to first kind of step back and take maybe a broad view of First Friday. I want to look at the history of this. Like, Jesse, I know you remember First Fridays kind of from the very beginning when you were a teenager, right?
Well, yeah. They started in the late 80s and 90s. But I started hanging out in the Roosevelt, like downtown Phoenix Arts District, as we called it, in like 2002. Like as soon as I could drive, I was hanging out down there. And I was asked by, you know, I was asked if I would just go on First Friday, and I didn't really quite get it. I was just taking it all in as like a young teen.
Yeah.
Seeing fire artists and muralists and like street taggers and people busking along the streets, maybe pop into Modified.
Mm-hmm.
But like, what Greg was saying, we had a lot of space to play with. It was not like – I didn't see it as a wasteland. I saw it as like a big playground where we could like express ourselves and, just have fun and uninhibited in a way.
Yeah. And at the time, Greg, like downtown Phoenix, as you mentioned, 60% of Roosevelt Row being vacant is kind of wild if you drive down it now. But I mean, think about like what downtown Phoenix was like back then in the late 80s, early 90s when First Fridays were really getting underway. Like it was a ghost town after 5 o'clock when everyone left work, right?
Literally, downtown Phoenix was one of the top results if you Googled ghost towns in Arizona back in 2012. So, it's changed significantly.
Let me ask you, Jesse, about your memories of downtown Phoenix then. Like,
sure.
When you went down there, did you feel like, man, oh, man, this is not much going on?
No, not really. I mean, no, I've always been like a nightlife person. And what was really interesting for me is like the quality of people that were down there. And we were kind of, you know, excited that people were considering it like, you know, a place where you wouldn't want to go. We used to go like, you know, to maybe Scottsdale or something for the night, or Tempe even. So the fact that most people didn't have their eyes on it yet, like artists and developers eventually had their eyes on the downtown area. But for me, it didn't feel so dead. It was great to be able to just like meet people and not be inundated with like so many like loud sound systems. And our friends like would drive around on a truck, and and this was before the road closures, right?
Yeah.
Like, so you'd see like people, like whole bands in the back of a truck, like the Madcaps driving around and circling the space, you know?
Yeah.
And then another band, Joe Willie Smith and all of his Metropophobia people, once that place closed, like they would just do their sound sculptures out in the dirt lot that is now the Point Roosevelt,
right.
That whole area.
Yeah. Space to play with, though, like you said.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, just to, like, drive it home. It didn't ever really feel dead, especially on the weekends.
Yeah.
But, you know, I was in school. I wasn't there, like, on, like, a Monday night or something. It was Fridays, you know, Thursday, Friday, Saturday we're on.
Right, but it sounds like because downtown Phoenix wasn't so developed, Greg, like, it was this space for the underground to kind of take control. And that's kind of the origins of First Friday. It was a little weird.
It was an empty canvas. We used to joke that you could pitch a tent in the middle of Roosevelt and be able to camp overnight. And that's not far from the truth.
Wow.
And that empty canvas, those buildings that were planned to be demolished, created an opportunity, a transitory opportunity for artists to come in and invent things that wouldn't have been affordable in almost any other context. And
yeah.
So these incredible performances, a quarter-acre installation, all kinds of interventions that sort of transform the urban landscape through the hands and minds of artists really was the opportunity that was organic, thriving, and it was always evolving and changing.
Yeah. So let's talk about First Fridays and how they have changed, right? Like, they really have grown just exponentially. And that happened, I think, probably in the first couple of decades of this event. It started to be less underground, started to be more mainstream, maybe a little bigger. Greg, like, when you think about the rise of First Friday, do you think it sort of mirrors the rise of downtown Phoenix and sort of people moving in, development coming in? Did it come faster than you expected?
It came actually much faster in spite of a recession. And in spite of COVID, there were a lot of impacts that sort of shifted the evolution, but it did change much faster, I think, than anyone originally anticipated.
What did that look like from your point of view, Jesse? Like the change that came, the prices going up, gentrification is a word that comes to mind.
Yeah. And like when I was hanging out downtown at the beginning, it was also like not totally concentrated on Roosevelt. It was like Central and Madison before like America West Arena was built and like Bob was built, which whatever they're called now. who knows? But, you know, I went away to NAU and I would come back and it was like a really interesting perspective because I wasn't there every weekend. Mm-hmm. So I'd come home every few months and I'm like, whoa, First Friday's like getting bigger. So it's like watching your niece or nephew grow up where it's like, whoa, you know, they just keep like jumping back, like jumping to get bigger and bigger exponentially. So. Yeah. It was kind of a place eventually where I just didn't want to be. I was, like, troubled with, you know, like, trying to get down there and, like, the things that I wanted to see, all the places that were, you know, near and dear to me were starting to close or be demolished or they're, you know, selling the spot to get out of there as fast as they can. So I found myself hanging elsewhere. I would hang down downtown on like third Fridays. Jerusha Funk would play there every third Friday. Or I even remember like an early rivalry of like, oh, the musicians are like clogging up too much of the artist space now. We need to have second Saturdays for the musicians and first Fridays for the artists. And I mean, so over the years, it just like,
yeah,
I saw it grow. But, you know, from afar, from a distance, like I said, I was already over it.
You were already over it.
Yeah, I feel like a hipster saying that, but you know.
It's okay, it's okay. Go ahead, Greg.
The event was really designed in the early days to draw people into the neighborhood to support the new small businesses that were starting, whether it was Fate, whether it was Modified Arts, whether it was Carly's, really the first restaurant to open in the neighborhood, because they didn't have the traffic, they didn't have the residential population that they keep their doors open. And a lot of those businesses made their money on First Fridays. Mm-hmm. But even back then, the vision was always a 365, 24/7 urban walkable community. Dense, diverse, walkable were the kinds of things that we wanted to see evolve in the neighborhood.
Yeah. Okay. We're going to head to a break now. When we come back, we'll talk about the changes coming to First Friday starting this week and the future of this signature event. Greg, Jesse, thanks so much. We'll be right back after the break. Good morning. It is the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, research breakthroughs are leading scientists closer to understanding schizophrenia and the genes linked to the disorder.
I mean, if you look at the European studies in the past, they've basically given us roughly, 280 genetic regions where there's probably a gene. And we've identified 100 more, when we've included these African ancestry populations as well.
We'll hear the results of the largest schizophrenia gene study to include people with Black or African ancestry. But first, we're back with more of our roundtable discussion on First Fridays, which will not look the same if you head downtown. Organizers will no longer be closing down Roosevelt Street for the event, which means there won't be vendors lined up along the block selling art and all kinds of other things. It's in response to violence that's been escalating in recent months as the monthly event has gotten more crowded and what organizers recently described as ugly. I'm joined by artist and community organizer Jesse Demery. Good morning.
Good morning.
And Roosevelt Row CDC founder Greg Esser this morning. And Greg, I want to go back to you here. I outlined kind of the changes that are coming for First Fridays there. Tell us, why do you think that Roosevelt Row leaders had to make that decision? It sounds like we said it was a long time coming, but it sounds like there were other factors than just the sort of escalating fights and things like that that started to break out. It sounds like it was a neighborhood reaction as well.
That's absolutely true. And I will preface this by saying this is not the first time we've gone through a cycle where the police department has wanted to focus all of the activity on Roosevelt Street just by virtue of management and resources required to provide safety for a crowd of this size. We initially started as a small sort of dispersed number of block closures, and that drew a crowd into downtown in order to ensure safety. Law enforcement then required more staffing, more resources, and they believed that the better solution was to close Roosevelt Street, which we did around 2010. And there was a huge negative backlash from the surrounding neighborhoods, from the community. And one of the outcomes of that was the Pi Social, to sort of heal all of the wounds that came from this very divisive discussion more than a decade ago about closing Roosevelt versus leaving First Friday as a more organic event that connects a lot of different things.
That's interesting.
And we've always viewed Roosevelt Row as the connective tissue between other assets in the downtown community, not as something that you draw a box around. Mm. So we're really making connections to the rest of the community. And those things are continuing to grow. There's new art space on Van Buren and 24th Street. There's new activity in the Arizona Center. There are new markets there. There's new activity in a lot of other places. Grand Avenue has been an important arts district and area where activity continues to thrive and grow. And so we end up having more arts activity all the time rather than just once a month. And ironically, we've trained people to think about coming downtown one time a month. Yeah. They should think about coming down all the time, and that's really our goal.
So that's an interesting kind of byproduct of getting First Fridays to be so successful. Now people only come down for that.
Right. Yeah. And we want people all the time. And there's always something to experience.
Tell us more about the backlash you got when you first started closing down Roosevelt Row. What did neighbors not like about that? What did people not like about it?
It drew people to a single location, and it really sort of siphoned off activity from other areas in the downtown. And that was not our intent. But that was a byproduct of having to put everybody into one place. That also drove our costs as the organizer up. We had to pay a lot more in order to provide that single location. We had to increase rates for people to participate, and that resulted in a lot of people who were the founders and early artists not being able to afford to participate anymore. And we're going through that same kind of cycle again. The costs that a Roosevelt closure versus an organic event require aren't sustainable with the business model that sort of established the initial creation of space for artists to sell work during the event.
Yeah. Jesse, what's your reaction to this change, to no longer closing down streets? Like, what do you hope it might lead to?
I would hope it leads to discussions with the artists that have been there the whole time. I would really love to see, like, whether or not it's somebody coming to the Evans Churchill board for the voice of all of the artists, or if there's like sort of like a town hall panel kind of discussion to really get back to the roots of it, so that they could guide everybody to a new vision of what First Friday could be, or just what a healthy arts district could look like in this sprawling city.
Right. It's a very sprawling city.
It's very sprawling. And I mean, that's really interesting to know about the police wanting to concentrate the corralling everybody in, because that actually feels like a really great way for kids to like organize and like group together. But yeah, I would like to see other places be able to blossom around Melrose and places on Central, or we just need to get back to places allowing space for artists to grow. Like when we were in the last few months of the closure, I work at MySpace, and it's a gallery sound incubator right next to the old Carly's. It's part of John's Spot. People would just walk by, because I think the brand or the aesthetic of First Friday turned into something that even a gallery seemed unnatural. So people wouldn't really want to walk into a space, but that's how I remembered it.
That's interesting, because so it started with galleries and with artists.
Yeah, it started like houses turning into galleries, and you'd be able to walk in and get some crackers and wine or something
lots
and like meet
wine.
The artist. Lots and lots of box wine. So I guess I feel unaffected in a way, because my space will still be there. More spaces need to pop up, and I think it won't be the end of it. There will be other places and other options for, you know, in the future
yeah.
For us to gather and like, yeah. celebrate art.
But. What do you think when you hear that, Greg? Like, it sounds like from Jesse's point of view and from many of the artists' point of view who have been there a long time, that like First Friday lost its soul almost, and like this maybe could bring it back to its roots?
Local media has been predicting the demise of First Friday for as long as I've been involved, for decades.
That's
now.
True.
And every time there's a change, it's predicted to be the end of First Friday. And I want to clarify, there's a distinction between the street closure mm-hmm. and First Fridays.
Right.
If I could take something off the calendar, it would be Mondays, not First Fridays. But First Fridays will always be an event in downtown Phoenix, and it will continue to evolve without a street closure, with a street closure. And we're interested in really focusing on that arts identity, which is a unique mm-hmm. character element of Roosevelt Row. So mm-hmm. how do we serve artists? How do we serve the new residents that are now part of this? We've got a huge population of renters, so they're transitory residents in the neighborhood. What are their needs? And this transition is another listening moment. So Roosevelt Row CDC, the Evans Churchill Community Association are both spending a lot of time doing stakeholder meetings, listening to people, partnering with Downtown Phoenix, Inc., and looking holistically with ArtLink, who's the sort of founder and organizer mm-hmm. of First Fridays as an event, which is now a statewide organization. Looking at how all of these things sort of work together and continue to foster the arts, serve residents, best serve stakeholders, and that includes the vendors who have been a part of this event, again, for decades, many of them. How do we best serve all of those needs in a way that makes the most people happy?
Yeah, but there are big challenges in that, right? Like artists can't afford to live on Roosevelt Row anymore. There are very few galleries or craft spaces left. I mean, what's your reaction to that, Jesse?
That, you know, what the reaction to, oh my gosh. Well, we're a very resilient group of people.
But I mean, like, I guess the question is how can,
right,
how can First Friday Roosevelt Row be more about supporting the arts, creating a true arts district? Because it is like, mm-hmm. that's, as you said, Greg, like the cultural touchstone of this place. Those mm-hmm. artists mm-hmm. and that presence matters. But what do you do when they can't afford to be there?
Rent caps.
So,
rent caps.
Go ahead.
Rent control.
The reason artists first started buying buildings along Roosevelt and along Grand Avenue is because they were displaced for the construction of the basketball arena
right.
and for the baseball field. Those were warehouses that were torn down, displacing artists. They realized in Phoenix that ownership was one of the ways to have a voice in how the city evolved.
Yeah.
And that happened along Grand Avenue and Roosevelt. But now, again, they're buying in new locations, and that activity is continuing. It's mm-hmm. just not in the same locations anymore. There's a show up right now in Miami at Miami Artworks, which is a group of artists that used to be on Roosevelt
yeah.
and migrated to Miami. So that activity is continuing. It doesn't have the same central force as it did for a period of time on Roosevelt Street. But that's now got a more dispersed and more permanent presence in the DNA of Roosevelt than it had when the land was mostly vacant.
That's interesting.
20 years ago.
Right, right. And it's yeah. kind of the way, right, Jesse, that mm-hmm. cities go. Like they
yeah.
grow, they evolve, and the artists kind of get there first, figure it out, and then, you know, go find the new place when they are
absolutely.
Done.
Absolutely. Yeah. Michael and Joanna, 23, started with Thought Crime. And then they got kicked out of that space because it was being demolished. And they went to Firehouse, and then that space was demolished. And then, I mean, the resilience is, like, truly extraordinary and, like, very just really inspirational for a lot of artists that then they moved out to Miami and bought up a lot of the downtown and kept, like, recreating just like a phoenix.
Yeah.
You
just
know?
Like a phoenix.
Just keep reimagining and rebuilding, relocating, yeah. and yeah, I see a lot of really good possibilities, but it's going to happen within the community that yeah. I feel safe with, the artists.
All right.
You know,
all right. I think that's a good place to end it.
Sure.
That is artist and community organizer Jesse Demery and Roosevelt Row CDC founder artist as well, Greg Gesser. Thank you both for being here. Appreciate it very much.
Thanks so
Thank
much.
Thank you so much.
Good morning. It is the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. Atomic is a new ASU platform that creates AI-generated versions of ASU faculty's lectures, cutting down often long videos to short clips for quicker learning. The idea is to give students personalized learning modules tailored to their schedule. But our next guest reports many ASU professors are disturbed by the way their lectures are being chopped up and used out of context, and they were blindsided by the platform's launch. Sam Cole is co-founder of 40 104 Media, where she covers the internet and AI, and she's on the line now to tell us more. Good morning, Sam.
Good morning.
So
thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for coming on. Tell us how this is supposed to work. It's in beta now, we should say.
Yeah, so just from the little bit of testing that I've done and hearing from faculty that have tested this out also, what you do is you kind of prompt like you would ChatGPT. So you open up the ASU Atomic platform. It says, what do you want to learn about today? And in my case, I said, I want to learn about ethics and AI. So I typed in ethics and AI, and it asked me, how much time do you have to learn about this? What's your level? What do you want to learn? How quickly? Things like that. And then it generates a customized quote unquote learning module for each person who's using the platform.
Okay.
And then from there you get sections and readings and videos and all that stuff.
Okay. So the videos in particular are coming from, it sounds like, longer versions of ASU professors' lectures on various topics.
Yeah. So as far as I can tell, it's coming from Canvas videos. So Canvas is obviously the learning management system that ASU uses. And professors upload lectures to Canvas that students can then watch later or during class, whatever case may be. And the lectures are long and in context of the class. So, you know, you might take like an hour long lecture. That's a very complex topic. Obviously, in my case, I was testing ethics. That's a very complex issue in general, especially in AI. So it's taking those really long lectures and then turning it into 40-second to 2-minute snippets. Where I assume the platform is, you know, finding, oh, this professor mentioned the definition of AI, even though maybe the class was about film, the professor mentioned AI. So they snip out 40 seconds where the professor defines AI and then plug it into this learning module. And then from there, it generates text based on what that snippet said.
Right. So, and that's an actual example that you found in the module that it created for you, like a film class and a 30-second or 40-second clip about AI.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Yep. So tell us about what the professors that you spoke with had to say. It sounds like this started for you with a post that someone posted on Blue Sky.
Yeah. So Chris Hanlon, who's a U.S. literature professor at ASU, posted about this on Blue Sky and I think on Facebook, talking about how ASU had rolled out this new thing called Atomic, and that the faculty that he had spoken to had not heard of this before. He had never heard of it. He logged onto it and was like, oh, this is my face. These are my lectures. These are my colleagues' lectures. As far as I can tell, most faculty hadn't heard about it or weren't aware of it being developed before Friday, so a couple days ago. And one scholar that I talked to said, you know, I hadn't heard about this until you emailed me about it. And then I was walking through the phone with them saying, here's how your lecture was used in this AI program. And they were horrified.
Wow.
So most people just hadn't heard about it until Professor Hanlon had mentioned it online, but then especially in the last few days where it kind of gained some more traction.
Yeah. So some tension around the rollout for some of these professors you spoke with. Are they also concerned about sort of their intellectual material, their original ideas? I mean, do they own those to begin with, I guess, if they're posted on Canvas?
So it's tough because when you work at a university, a lot of your work is owned by that university. And,
right.
you know, the university might have intellectual property rights to your work, but it doesn't have exclusive rights in a lot of cases. So even if ASU does own, and as far as I can tell, it does own the content that goes up on Canvas. And if you're employed by ASU, obviously they have a right to that content. But what was concerning was the total lack of context and credit and further reading, even ways for learners to follow up on that content. So in a way, it's like they own, ASU might own that content, but it's stripping the ownership of the thoughts and the preparation that went into that content from the people who created it, which would be the professors and the faculty. So it is an ownership issue, but it's also the faculty that I talked to were saying, you know, I'm not trying to be compensated for this, although that would be amazing because professors are not paid enough in general across the country. But, you know, it's not about credit and compensation. It's about, you know, reflecting the thought and the time that I put into creating these materials for my students because I care about them. Then, you know, stripped and cannibalized and chopped up into slop for AI is very concerning for these scholars. So I think that's really the issue for a lot of folks.
This comes, Sam, as AI is really kind of upending education in a lot of ways, like whether it's at the university level or down the line. But I think ASU in general has been really positive about AI and its potential in education. It sounds like that's what the goal is of creating a platform like this. Tell us about that kind of context in which this is happening.
Yeah. So, I mean, AI, is obviously something that's being pushed into or embraced by, however you want to look at it, institutions and organizations and industries, regardless. Since academia is dealing with this, there are tons of different industries. My industry, journalism, is dealing with grappling with how to use AI and if to use AI. So I think that's the context that ASU is trying to keep up with. They're saying, we don't want to be behind on AI innovation and AI powered tools, and we want to be able to offer these things to what is essentially a public product. It's like, I was signing up for it. It's $5 a month after a free trial. It's not for students or ASU community. It's for the public. So they're trying to stay ahead, so to speak, for, the sake of staying ahead, but it's not actually something that's providing value in a way that reflects ASU's actual quality education. It's definitely, what's being produced is not good, honestly. It's pretty bad content and full of errors. So even if it was like a good product, I think it would be questionable. But the fact that it's a bad product and rolled out pretty, halfway is just even more concerning.
All right, we'll leave it there for now. Sam Cole, co-founder of 404 Media, joining us to talk about this story. Sam, thank you for coming on. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
And KJZZ reached out to ASU for comment, received this response, quote, "A pilot launch of the program began in April. The pilot explores how ASU can use existing digital content in new ways to reach learners beyond those enrolled in degree programs." Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. Researchers have found more than 100 new genes that they believe are linked to schizophrenia. And part of the reason they found them, according to our next guest, is that they looked in different places than they've looked before. Ayman Fanous is chair of psychiatry at the University of Arizona College of Medicine, Phoenix, and at Banner University Medicine Center in Phoenix. He was part of this study conducted at more than a dozen schools. He spoke with my co-host, Mark Brody, about the findings about what and what they mean, and they started with what he and his colleagues were specifically looking for.
So basically, if you look at the history of genetics in the last 100 plus years, even in the last 20 to 30 years, the vast majority of studies have been in European ancestry populations, say in Europe and the United States. They have really not covered populations in other parts of the world almost at all, including in Asia, Africa, Latin America, etc. So one of the issues there is, can we generalize findings from European ancestry populations? And it's certainly no surprise that this kind of disparity in studying has been taking place. I mean, certainly these countries are much richer governments, et cetera, that can spend a lot more money on science than, say, countries in Africa and Asia. But the question again is, can we generalize the findings in European ancestry populations to other ethnic groups? And that question really has remained unanswered for quite some time now. And the reason that's an important question is, the question ultimately comes down to, are we looking at the same disorders biologically in European ancestry populations as we are in other populations?
Well, so having done this research now, do you feel better equipped to answer the question about whether you can make that generalization?
Yes, absolutely. We've taken a number of approaches in the last few years. Most importantly, we've recruited a lot more African ancestry patients. And, this is a relatively recent phenomenon, I'd say, going back maybe 10, 15 years. Now, if you look at the history of genetics and psychiatric disorders, it goes back much further than that. And one of the reasons we've been able to do that is that we've been able to recruit patients for very large, what we call biobanks. And one of the most important biobanks here in the United States is the one that's built by the Department of Veterans Affairs. So this has allowed us to have a much larger collection of patients with all kinds of different disorders, not just schizophrenia and other psychiatric disorders, but hypertension, diabetes, et cetera, et cetera. And it's given us a much better opportunity to study pretty much all disorders in other ancestries. So we've been able to collect to date what would be the largest study of African ancestry, as well as other ancestries as well, African ancestry patients with schizophrenia, and to try to understand sort of the genetic basis of schizophrenia in this large database, And try to see if it extends to the European ancestry population as well. In other words, are the results that we're seeing in one ethnic group, namely the African ancestry group, are they more or less the same as we're seeing in the European group? Are these disorders more or less the same biologically across these ethnic groups?
Well, and am I right that among other things, what you found is that there are more than 100 genetic links to schizophrenia that maybe you hadn't known about just based on the European studies?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, if you look at the European studies in the past, they've basically given us roughly, 280 genetic regions where there's probably a gene. So let's just say, for simplicity's sake, they've identified 280 genes, more or less. And we've identified 100 more, when we've included these African ancestry populations as well. So it's been very impactful in terms of getting us to a larger number of genes, getting us to a larger number of biological processes. And one of the other important things that's happened in this study is that because these two populations have very different histories, one, of course, as we know, the African population is the original human population. And so you've got a very diverse population in the African ancestry. And consequently, the genetics, the genome is much more diverse in the African population. So one of the really beneficial impacts of that is that you're able to identify the location of genes in a much more precise way. In other words, let's just say you have a gene as a needle in a haystack. When you include multiple ancestries, because of the great diversity, you get much more precision. So you get a needle in a much smaller haystack, and it allows us to more precisely identify which genes are actually involved, and even maybe even more importantly, which variations in the gene, which mutations are causing a particular protein to not function properly, and therefore a particular cell not to function properly, namely a neuron. So this study has been beneficial in two important ways. Firstly, to increase the number of genes that we are confident that have an impact in schizophrenia, and secondly, to actually narrow the regions where we think those genes are.
Does this have potential practical implications for something like, for example, diagnosing schizophrenia or treating schizophrenia, or maybe even at some point trying to prevent it from showing its symptoms?
Yes, I believe so. I mean, we're certainly quite a ways off from any of those possibilities, but in terms of diagnosis, now that we have a much larger number of genes that we can actually assay, we can test. It would be possible to, I believe, have more predictive power to determine who is at higher risk of getting the illness. And perhaps if we had that information, we might be able to intervene earlier, such as maybe starting people on low doses of medication when they have early symptoms, things like that. In terms of treatment, we're now able to identify many more pathways where we might be able to have drugs that basically target these genes and might sort of intervene in the processes that lead to schizophrenia. So there might be greater drug discovery possibilities.
It sounds like what you're saying is there are more potential ways to get at the disease now with these extra links.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Of course, a lot of work needs to be done to identify, ways we might be able to intervene. And, there's lots of different aspects of that work that will need to take place, but that definitely opens the door much wider.
Is it possible that there are still more links out there that we just haven't found yet?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, schizophrenia, like many what we call common disorders, is very polygenic, meaning that it's not like one gene that causes the illness, as you would see in, say, cystic fibrosis. It's more likely that it's like hundreds of genes, and whether it's 300 or 400 or 700 or 800, we don't really know. So that work is ongoing, but I think we're getting closer and closer to finding out.
All right, Ayman, thank you so much for the conversation. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Mark.
Ayman Fanous is chair of psychiatry at the University of Arizona College of Medicine, Phoenix, and Banner University Medical Center.
All right, that'll do it for today's edition of the show. We will, of course, be back with you again tomorrow morning with much more. Don't forget to follow us on Instagram. We are at KJZZ The Show, and you can sign up for our newsletter. It is called Radio Heads, and in it, find out what we're up to, check out some of our favorite segments you might have missed each week. It is a good read in your inbox, I promise. You can sign up at theshow.kjzz.org. The show was produced by Sativa Peterson, Nick Sanchez, Amber Victoria Singer, Athena Ankra, and Ayanna Hamilton, as well as Bruce Drummond. Sky Shout is our digital editor. Chad Snow is our news director. The show was created by John Hoban, and our executive producer is Amy Silverman. For Mark Brody, I'm Lauren Gilger. Thanks for joining us.